We've all heard it said that the earth may be running out of fresh water, and that some places are in a very dire situation when it comes to water supply. But just how do we measure water scarcity, and is there a better way? Dr. Kate Brauman, lead scientist for the Global Water Initiative at the Institute on the Environment at the University of Minnesota, thinks there is a better way, and she joins us now by phone. Dr. Brauman, welcome to the Roadhouse.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Well, I won't repeat the title of your article, but you talk about water scarcity, and what do you mean by water scarcity?
Well, that's a great question, actually, because it could potentially mean a lot of things. And really the piece that I think that we need to pay a lot of attention to is how much of the water that's available to us are we using or using up? So a desert which nobody lives in isn't necessarily a water-scarce place. It's just an arid place. It's a desert. Whereas even here in Minnesota, where we have lots and lots of water, if we're using a lot of it or we're using a lot of the available water, we might feel water stressed because the way that our infrastructure is built and the water that's easy for us to get to isn't necessarily there. And so thinking about this ratio of how much is available and then how much of it are we using is the part that's really important when it comes to management.
So what does it tell you? I mean, when you determine that there's a scarcity of water in a particular place, how does it help you manage?
So there's different kinds of scarcity, and that's one of the things that we're really starting to be able to figure out. And that's one of the things that's really different about this new way of thinking about measuring. So maybe we're scarce of water all the time. If we take our whole annual water budget and we realize that we're using up all of it or almost all of it, there's not that much to do except use less water. We can't make more. But on the other hand, it's totally possible that we feel water stressed because there's a few months of the year when there's not as much water available as we want to use. And then we could actually think about moving water around in time, not necessarily moving water to new places. So we could build water storage, or we could think about changing the kinds of activities we're using water for so that we use the water during periods when more water is available.
So is what you're talking about different from what has traditionally been used as a measurement of water consumption?
So there are different kinds of measurements of water consumption, and there's good reasons that people use all of them. And traditionally, one of the things that we've paid the most attention to is thinking about, well, how much water are we actually pumping out of the ground or taking out of a river? And we call that water withdrawal. So it's quite literally what we're withdrawing or taking out of a water body. When we start to think about big scales, though, the whole state of Minnesota or the whole Mississippi watershed, then we have to think about what happens to that water when we take it out and use it. And it turns out that actually we don't use up very much of the water that we take out and that we take into our homes or even that we put on our farm fields. So when I turn the tap on, I drink some of the water, but most of the water goes down the drain. And the water that goes down the drain ends up getting shunted to a water treatment plant, and then it actually ends up back in the Mississippi River for me here in the Twin Cities. And it turns out that in St. Louis, they're probably drinking that same water. So if we counted up all of the water withdrawals coming out, that wouldn't account for the fact that we're sending a lot of water back. And so at a big scale, the thing that we've started really focusing on is how much water consumption is there, or how much water is evaporating, being used up by plants, ending up in the atmosphere. And it's not gone, but we don't get the chance to reuse it, at least this time around the water cycle.
Describe the water cycle just a little bit.
I mean, sure thing.
Is the Earth making any more water?
The Earth is not making any more water. But the good news is that the Earth isn't really running out of water either. So we're pretty much stuck with what we've got. But that water moves around a lot. So,
but there's so much of the water that's salt water,
yes.
Right? So, I mean, describe the difference. How do you deal with the fact that the salt water is not usable, particularly easily usable anyway?
Right. So what's pretty interesting is that the oceans actually play a big part in our freshwater cycle, too. So water evaporates. We've all seen it happen. We've all seen our plants wilt and our glass of water that we left out get lower and lower. That happens in the oceans just like it happens on land. And that water ends up in the atmosphere, and it moves around in the atmosphere, and then it rains back down. So actually, the oceans in some ways are providing us with a lot of our water. But on the other hand, you're exactly right. We can't drink any of that water that's full of salt unless we take the salt out of it. And so when it comes to thinking about how much water is available to us, we really have to think about fresh water. And that limits hugely what we can, you know, the amount of water on Earth that we can actually make use of.
And the water that you use in Minneapolis from your tap and put back down the drain in one form or another gets reused potentially down the line, but it's got to be treated.
It does, and it actually gets treated coming in and going out.
Mm-hmm.
So the water in Minneapolis, we're not quite as good as you are up in Grand Marais, but it's relatively clean, but there's still lots of stuff in it, both organics and other kinds of stuff you don't want to drink. So we do quite a bit of water treatment. And then we do obviously put a lot of stuff into our water in our households. And so the Metropolitan Council here in the Twin Cities metro area does a lot of water treatment before it goes back into the Mississippi.
But that isn't something that you particularly considered in this article.
No, we didn't.
How do you treat the water?
But okay. It really matters because
sure.
Whether or not, you know, if you live in a place where people are not treating their water, then that can have a big impact mm-hmm. on how mm-hmm. functionally available that water that comes to you downstream is.
Okay, and you looked around the U.S. and applied these standards, and what did you find about scarcity in the U.S. and maybe the world?
So some of it looks just like you would expect. Places on the West Coast where it's arid, California, and then in the Great Plains where we're pumping in the Ogallala Aquifer to irrigate corn are places where we're using up a lot of the annually available water. But we also saw that there are actually lots of places, including around Chicago and even in Florida, where during dry years, they're using up actually a big fraction of their total available water. So it's not that the actual total volume is as small as it might be in, say, California, but if all of your pipes are built so that, you know, the water that comes in has to be waist high, and the water falls below that, you've got a problem if your intake pipe is too high. And globally, the thing that we saw that's, I think, important and we need to think about is that there's actually not that many places in the whole world where we're using more than 75% of the annually available water. But there are lots of places that are dry on a seasonal basis or during dry years. And so those are places where I think there's a lot of hope. There's things we can do for management, but that we need to think about differently because it's a different kind of water scarcity.
What do you mean think about differently, that we shouldn't be populating those areas? Or?
Well, some of them don't actually have a lot of population. So, for example, there are parts of northern Africa around the Sahara and parts of places that are really dry. You don't need very many people. And you can use a large fraction of the available water. But also there are places like parts of India where actually if you look at the whole year when they have the monsoon, they're not using up a huge fraction of the total annual water. But because the water comes as a monsoon during some times of year and then it's really dry during other times of year and they're using a lot of groundwater, those are places where changing the management could really matter in terms mm-hmm. of helping make water available when people need to be able to use it.
And what percentage do you think is the breaking point for sustainability in what percentage of the available water can you use and expect it to be sustainable?
Well, that's one thing that we saw that was pretty interesting, is that a lot of the places where, if you looked at an annual time step, so over the whole year, places that looked like they were maybe using half of their available water, when we zoomed in and looked at those for each month of the year, actually what turned out to be happening is that there were a few months where almost all of the water was being used up and a few months where almost none of the water was being used up. So you might think that, oh, 50%, that's got to be okay. But on the monthly time step, that's where it really looked like, oh, gosh, maybe that is a big problem. And so I think we need to think about looking at shorter time steps and also really zooming in to as small of areas as we can look at. You know, I don't know if there's a real answer to this, to what's sustainable in the long run question. The good news is that because water cycles, when we stop using water, at least if it's surface water, we get to try again next year.
You're listening to The Roadhouse here on WTIP, coming from Grand Marais. I'm Dick Swanson, and I'm speaking right now with Dr. Kate Brauman, who is a lead scientist for Global Water Initiative at the University of Minnesota. We're talking about water scarcity. And you mentioned the Oglala Aquifer being overused, that it's not renewable. But it is renewable, is it not? Ultimately, it's renewable.
Well, it depends on how long you've got.
That's right.
So the Ogallala is actually a pretty special case when it comes to aquifers in the U.S. and even around the world. That water is tens of thousands of years old. It ended up there when the geology was really different here on the North American continent. And there's a tiny bit of recharge, but there's basically no water that's getting down into that aquifer. And so,
is that true out in California, too, where I know they've had the soils caving in and that sort of thing?
California is pretty different, actually. Huh. So those are very rechargeable aquifers, or they would be if they stayed in place, if they held their structure. But as they collapse, it's not clear that it's just like if you had a sponge and you smooshed it down and didn't let it back up, it wouldn't be able to hold as much water anymore. That's exactly what's happening in California. And as those aquifers collapse, there's actually less room in the geology to hold water. So they may never be able to recharge, even if they stopped pumping.
But are they more rechargeable if they would get it to a sustainable level of
absolutely
withdrawing? Yeah, okay.
Absolutely. It's a really different kind of geologic formation.
So what does this mean for the Nebraska farmers and Kansas farmers who are relying on that Ogallala aquifer?
That they are going to have to start deciding if they want to take the long view or the short view. You can grow corn out there without irrigation, but your yields are real low. And there are places where there are districts of farmers where they've basically made group decisions together that they're going to pump less so that this resource lasts for a longer time.
Mm-hmm. But it's still going to time out at some point.
It will time out at some point.
Are there many other places around the world where that's the case? That is kind of unique.
There are some, but, you know, having an aquifer that's that big and also that heavily used is pretty unusual.
Mm-hmm. And it's not rechargeable. I mean,
right.
It doesn't recharge.
Exactly.
Either. Well, okay, now, how does this information, how do you see that this information will inform politicians and policymakers in the future for controlling the water scarcity and making things sustainable? How is this going to be used?
Well, one thing that I really hope that people use it for is to try to look for models of things that we could do differently. So I try really hard to talk about water scarcity and not about water stress, because having limited amounts of water doesn't necessarily mean that people are experiencing water stress. And actually having a lot of water available doesn't necessarily mean you're not experiencing water stress. There's a lot of pieces about access and governance. So talking about some of these farmers, for example, in Nebraska who are working together to pump less. And so one thing that I think is really interesting and helpful when we're able to look at the whole world and use a single measure is to say, hey, if I'm popping up in bright red here, where are the other places that biophysically have similar characteristics that are also at this same level of water shortage but are experiencing less stress than I am? Mm-hmm. What are they doing to make this easier or more stress? What are they doing that I shouldn't do?
And is it pretty active out there right now about trying to manage and find the sustainability answer?
I think there's a lot of conversation about it, but the problem is that it's hard. People have to make decisions and choices about how they want to manage water as a resource, and historically there was so much of it we didn't ever have to. We never had to make those choices, and we're getting to the point where there's no way around having to make those choices and to limit ourselves, and it's not that that's not possible. I think there's lots of possibilities, both in terms of deciding what kinds of activities we want to make sure are available, but also doing lots of work to be more efficient when we use our water, so that when we're growing crops, we get more crop per drop.
Are you working on other studies right now or other analyses on this topic?
Some of the work that I'm doing is looking at this exact question of sort of how effectively are we using water when we do use it.
And just in a nutshell, how optimistic or pessimistic are you about how is it going to develop? Are we going to have crises?
I'm actually pretty optimistic. You could call me a serial optimist.
No, I think there's a lot of optimists down at the University of Minnesota because they've been thinking about this more than the average citizen, and yourself included. And we, sometimes when we think about it, it's hard to imagine a solution, but you can see it.
I really think it's possible. And part of the reason that it's possible is because in some areas we're doing great, but for lots of things, we're actually not doing that great. So if we're not getting very much crop per drop, actually maybe that's a good thing, because it means if we got more crop per drop,
crop per drop, that's good, okay.
Yeah, so if we got more crop per drop, we could get just as much crop with less water, or if we use the same amount of water, we could get more crops from it and feed more people.
And one of your colleagues has also studied, who we've talked to on this program, changing the what we eat would have a big impact on how much water we need.
Absolutely.
Animal agriculture being very high water use.
Yep.
So I'm glad you folks are all looking at this. I wonder if there's anything else you'd like to add, or if there's a resource you'd like to refer people to.
Well, I think there are really fantastic resources here at the University of Minnesota. So at the Institute on the Environment, we're trying to write and communicate a lot about the work that we're doing. There's a Water Resources Center here that's fantastic. And actually, there's lots of water work going on at the university. And, you know, I think all of it, as you said, we are optimists. We wouldn't be doing this if we weren't, right?
But you have to be a little concerned about some of the things you find, however.
I'm worried but optimistic. How's that for you?
That's excellent. All right. Well, keep up the optimism and keep working out there. We appreciate very much your taking the time to talk to us and all the work you're doing on this subject of water scarcity. Dr. Kate Brauman, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.